Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus,
Makalua,
the main team,
Mega Bears fan.
Hello and welcome to episode 382 of the Polycast. I'm Canis Albinus, who totally didn't have the audio bot muted. And I'm joined by our usual bevy of co-hosts, Makalua.
Who is the one who has to poke the audio gear bot?
The me and team.
Sometimes solution is just a bigger rock.
And Mega Bears fan.
Mornings are difficult. Saturday mornings are even more difficult.
Morning?
Not morning for me, but...
I'm on the West Coast. It's still 9 a.m.
Yeah.
I'm in Central Time Zone. It's only 11 a.m.
If this were the fall, football games wouldn't even have started yet.
Opposed to a different kind of update, because it's not a different month. So, what do we have in the update? Well, there are some new units, new map, some balance changes, etc. What are your guys' favorite? I like the trebuchet, even though I'm
yeah.
in serious doubt that it's going to be free range or anything, because not as these units until artillery are, but it is cool to see a trebuchet in the game.
Yeah, I had similar reservations. I saw somebody on Twitter tweet their excitement about the addition of a trebuchet, and I responded with something along the lines of, yeah, well, I hope it actually, like, works and doesn't just take one bombardment from the city and have to retreat or die.
Yeah, for sure.
But we've beaten that horse to death.
For a while.
Yeah, that horse has been thoroughly beaten after its death on this show.
And poster Aria Lyric grabbed a few screenshots from the update so you can see some of the strengths on the new units. And unfortunately, we do not have a screenshot of the trebuchet.
The trebuchet is 35-45.
Oh, okay.
Compared to what are the catapults and bombard?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up.
The poster did, but it's 39 here, 35 base strength.
For reference, the catapult has a bombard strength of 35.
Okay, and this is bombard strength 45. So this is, it'll hit cities harder, for sure. Now, is that good enough to break cities quickly? I don't think so, not with T-range. But maybe if they change siege, so that siege is good against cities, then we'll see.
The trebuchet is actually already on the wiki at fandom.com.
Cool.
And the bombard has a listed strength on that same wiki of 55. So the trebuchet comes right in between.
That's not bad.
Yeah,
I mean, that would make sense, considering its placement.
You know, we've been asking for something like that for a while, because there's a point where catapults aren't good enough, but it's still a long way to bombard.
Yeah, there's a medieval wall that defends against medieval mm-hmm. siege units that don't exist in the game.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Plus, trebuchets were used much more historically in general, than what we're seeing in catapults.
Even catapults, as they're depicted in Civilization, my understanding is exceedingly rare, because in the classical era, they weren't using catapults as much as they were using things like scorpions and onagers that, like, you know, are just basically ginormous crossbows.
Yeah. Ballistas.
And ballista, yeah.
They also used ladders throughout most of history.
Bat rams.
Yeah, that too.
Then we have two melee units, the man-at-arms and the line infantry, which neatly slot into the 45 base strength slot between the 35 sword and the 55 musket. And the line infantry is 65, and I assume the regular infantry, which already exists, is 75.
Oh, you think they're buffing it? Was it?
No, I think there's a new unit called the line infantry that upgrades to the existing infantry.
I thought the existing infantry was 70 base, but I must be misremembering that.
Maybe it is.
Did we know what tech it comes with? Because that might be the other thing.
Yeah, I'm surprised they're cramming two units into that upgrade path.
Also, with the way the unit is drawn, it probably doesn't take oil, right?
Infantry has a listed strength, again, on the wiki of 70, so I'm guessing they must be rebalancing that.
Yeah.
Probably.
Unless they want to make infantry like it was in Civ 4, where it's only 70 strength, but it gets a bonus against other infantry, because that was a thing. So they could do that again, too. But if line infantry doesn't take oil, and it looks like it shouldn't, then that's going to be a big plus for using it for quite some time.
Let's see, the wiki has men-at-arms listed with a melee strength of 45 and upgrades to musketmen. And then the musketmen has strength of 55, so that's 10 more.
Line infantry is 65 for the damage.
65. Okay, so it looks like you're getting diminishing returns from the going further in the tech tree.
No, it's just you're getting 10 per until you hit infantry. That's assuming they don't buff infantry, which they might.
Oh, yeah, if infantry does go up to 75, then yeah, it would be 10 each. But if infantry stays at 70, then it's diminishing returns.
Or like I said, they might be giving infantry a bonus against certain other unit classes rather than raw strength.
It might also be that infantry, it has something to do with the oil requirement that line infantry doesn't.
Yeah, line infantry just looks like those pre-modern rifles.
Yeah, it's basically riflemen from previous games.
Yeah, that's true.
So I assume it will require niter, which would be nice to have more than one unit in the game that requires that particular resource. Oh, actually, I guess Bombard needed it too, right?
Just checking on the Bombard. Nope, just one unit.
That's right.
What are Bombards? I've never heard of these.
I mean, I've never been a fan of niter to begin with because saltpeter is everywhere, but...
Let's get those horses using for cavalry to go pee on something.
Yeah. So we got some Civ balance updates that we know of so far. Spain gets fleets and armadas at mercantilism, as before. But all their trade routes give 3 gold, 2 faith, and 1 production. And that's tripled on other continents. Wait, what? We receive triple the bonus, so I guess that means the bonus they get for different resources?
Not sure.
I know. I assume it just means that if the trade route is intercontinental, then you get 9 gold, 6 faith, and 3 production instead of 3, 2, 1.
Okay, and foreign city continents get a 25% bonus production to districts and a free builder when founded. Philip also gets 5 strength against other religions, up 4. And the conquistador now gets its bonus of plus 10 strength with a religious unit within 1 hex rather than just the same tile.
Wow, these are pretty substantial buffs for Spain. Maybe Grimbeck won't hate them so much.
Everybody rolls them.
Chimer gets bonus to its aqueduct usage. They get plus 1 amenity and plus 1 faith per population when adjacent to when an aqueduct is built. Farms adjacent to holy sites provide plus 1 faith. Suva Yaraman the 7th gets holy sites, get plus 2 adjacency to rivers, food equal to adjacency, and plus 2 housing if on a river. It used to be just plus 2 food and plus 1 housing next to a river.
Mm.
And then the Domre replaces the trebuchet now, and it gets its strength boosted. We don't know to what yet. The Prasat gets 6 faith instead of 4, plus 0.5 culture per pop, tourism buff after flight equal to the stadium.
What's interesting about the Domre is that the description that's in the forum here doesn't say anything about its bombard strength, so I'm wondering if it replaces the trebuchet but is not actually a siege unit. Because I don't think it was a siege unit before. It was very effective at sieging cities, especially since the catapult was crap, but if the trebuchet is substantially better than the catapult and the Domre is not actually a siege unit, will it be as effective as the trebuchet at sieging cities, or is it going to fill more of like an anti-unit role now?
I don't think it's a Korean Hwacha situation, but I don't know. We don't have any defined writing for that. China gets the additional bonus of a random Eureka and inspiration for completing a wonder. The Eureka or inspiration is from the Wonders era, not your own.
So
Mapuche, go ahead.
I was going to say, so that's going to be weird if you try to come back later and build something, but you've already gotten through all the checks, then you just get no bonus.
Yeah. Well, this is in addition to their existing bonuses.
Well, no extra bonus, let's put it that way.
Well, I think the existing bonus is only applied to ancient and classical wonders anyway, so it doesn't last very long.
The existing bonus was not related to wonders at all. The existing bonus was you get 50% from Eureka's instead of 40.
Oh, I was thinking of the leader benefit then, I think.
The leader benefit was...
Yeah, it was that you can spend builders on ancient and classical wonders to increase their production.
I thought it was more than just ancient and classical.
Let's see, according to the wiki, builder charges can complete 15% of the production cost of ancient and classical wonders.
That's new to me.
Yeah, that was always one of my biggest issues with China, like especially playing on like a harder difficulty, you know, like above King, where it's really hard to get a lot of those ancient classical wonders because the AI start with all the bonuses. Like, it's just incredibly difficult to use his power. And I don't know why they cut it off at classical. Like, I feel like it should at least go through the medieval era.
I guess because none of the wonders after the medieval era are Chinese. Is that true? Is the Forbidden Palace in Civ 6?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Okay.
I think that the Forbidden Palace might be on the civic tree instead of the tech tree, but I think it is still either late medieval or early Renaissance era.
I would think it would be medieval.
But yeah, very, very difficult to use Kunshi Huang's ability at higher difficulties. So I really am surprised that they didn't just extend that to work, like the builder charge thing, to work through the medieval and or Renaissance era.
I can understand how that might be ridiculous, though, because you get free workers from a lot of things in the later game. So you're like, oh, free wonder.
Yeah, I mean, you're still, I think, limited to, you know, using one charge per turn, and it's only 15%, so it's not, like, a huge amount.
Yeah, but 15 times 5 is, what, 75? You can build a worker a lot faster than you can build a wonder.
Yeah, I guess that's true, and that does basically give you a wonder in, like, 5 or 6 turns.
Yeah.
Depending on...
And also to concentrate production in a way that you normally could not.
For the Mapuche, cities with a governor get plus 5 production, plus 5 or plus 5% production, plus 5% culture, plus 10% experience, your combat experience to units trained, tripled in non-Mapuche cities. All cities within 9 tiles of a governor gain plus 4 loyalty. Larturo's ability switches to plus 10 strength versus free cities, golden age, and heroic age civs, moved from the civ to the leader directly. And defeated enemy loyalty drop double to 40 against city, against golden and heroic ages, and no loyalty drop from pillaging. And the Chenimal gets plus 1 production. Canada gets buffed too. Winfer Laurier's ability goes from plus 1 food, plus 1 production, plus 1 food to camps only on snow and tundra. Now gets plus 2 to mines and lumber mills, and plus 2 to camps and farms. So snow and tundra is actually relatively decent for Canada now, like actually good.
They basically seem to become grasslands.
Pretty much. And the Mountie now has 2 build charges, is cheaper to build, and is higher strength.
Yeah, I always use the Mountie as a cheap naturalist anyway.
Yeah. Georgia gets shafted yet again. Combat victories provide plus 50% unit strength in combat destroyed as faith instead of double faith from protectorate wars. And the Kev Sur now replaces the Man-at-Arms.
I wonder if they'll make some of these upgradable into, or if they'll have the same problems as they've had for so long.
I've seen some scuttlebutt that the Berserker and Samurai may also replace the Bandit Arms. as opposed to being hard builds as they are now?
That would be nice. That would make them more useful as unique units.
And I think that's all we really know about the patch as yet. It comes out on the 22nd of April, 2021, which is 5 days from now.
From now, as of this recording, that is.
As of this recording, yes.
And then that's supposed to be it, right, for the whole New Frontiers thing?
That's what they've said.
For this season, yeah.
Yeah, so this is the last game update that we actually know for sure is going to happen. Everything after that is going to be up in the air. Until they grace us with a formal announcement.
We'll see what comes of it.
I have to imagine there would be at least one additional like balance patch coming after this at some point.
Yeah, because you can't really change that many things and have it not screw up something.
You're right, especially a month after like releasing new content, you know?
Yeah.
So I can't imagine that this will be it for Civilization VI. And I'm still, you know, like wondering if there might be a second New Frontier season. That would not surprise me.
I think I would be okay with that, but I don't think it's likely.
Gotta go with the Paradox models, right?
Just keep adding expansions until nobody can afford the game because it's $300 or something.
Yeah, give the game 10 years of life or whatever.
Except, unlike Paradox, Firaxis does discount its expansion packs lower than 50%.
Yeah.
So oh, yeah.
Paradox does that eventually. It's just when they're, like, years old.
Many years old.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the ones, like, more than 5 years ago actually do get discounted more than 50%. Not that I'm really defending that, but technically speaking.
Yeah, I recently started playing the Crusader Kings board game, which comes with a little flyer inside of it for an ad for 90% off Crusader Kings 2. Not
yeah.
a no discount on Crusader Kings 3, but 90% off of Crusader Kings 2, but no discount on any of the DLC. So you're still on the hook for the other $200 that you have to pay for DLC to get the game up to snuff with what everyone else is playing.
The good news is CK2 is free to play now.
90% discount.
Oh, good. 90% off of free. Let's see. Carry the 1, divide by pi.
Just divide by 0, you'll be fine.
You just made it undefined. Can't do that.
Well, have you tried playing with some of those succession laws? I'm joking, of course. I put more time in than I should into any of these games, and I know most of the succession laws in CK2 pretty well. But it did take more effort than usual to get those down.
The Crusader Kings board game, by the way, I think is quite good. My friends and I have very much enjoyed it. However, it errs much more on the, like, procedural storytelling aspect of its gameplay and not so much on the grand strategy element. So if you're going in looking for a very robust, like, hardcore strategy game, you will likely be disappointed. But if you are interested in a procedural story generator, it is very fun in that regard.
Okay, so 2K, in their infinite wisdom, decided to ruin gaming by creating their own launcher that basically made Civ largely impossible to play for almost a week. And as part of our job as public servants, we will be providing links to how to bypass said launcher, so you don't have to play with 5 instances of a program that probably contains Red Shell, again, running in the background. So yeah. This is a public service announcement to everybody working in the gaming industry. Nobody wants your stupid launcher. Nobody. Not
the
a
launchers step. Add steps rather than removing them. They're
nobody
annoying.
Wants them. Not a single person wants them.
I know people who don't even want Steam, let alone another third-party launcher that you can't get around. I have friends who will only buy from good old games, and I have this one friend in particular who I really think would enjoy Outer Wilds, but he can't play it because it's only on Steam and Epic and not on good old games yet.
Oh, by the way, the bypass doesn't work on Epic because Epic is even worse than Steam.
But we all knew that.
We didn't need to be told that, but I'm saying it just because completion.
just another data point on why Epic is worse than Steam.
I mean,
and worse than most things.
Other than all other 500 things we can list.
Yeah, I'm trying to wonder, like, what exactly is the publisher's, like, justification from, like, a consumer benefit standpoint for having a launcher? Like, is there any, does this provide any value to the, or any perceived value to the customer?
They'll claim it, but, yeah, but no.
Like, the only benefit that I see for the publisher, even, is that it's an opportunity to advertise, like, expansions or DLC or other games, but, like, they already do that in, like, the main menu of Civ 6 anyway, so...
Steam already does it for you, too.
Yeah, I mean, you're not necessarily opening Steam and going to the Civ webpage whenever you boot up Civ, so it's just dependent on whether or not one of those pop-up ads comes up, and they're not necessarily always for the same game that you're playing. But, again, even that doesn't matter because it's in the main menu for Civ 6. Now, that might not be the case for all of 2K's games, and I'm assuming this is a thing that 2K is just rolling out on all of their games, regardless of whether the games themselves already, like, provide this functionality. But, like, yeah, it is a... if it were preventing me from playing the game, I'd be pretty pissed. Luckily, I haven't had any problems with it so far, so I'm guessing this must depend on your computer setup or something.
Or maybe you just didn't play it between the time it was broken and the time it was fixed. Or quote-unquote fixed, because I've seen that some people still have problems.
And in 2K's defense, 2K is not the only, like, publisher that is doing these things.
We're seeing this crap a lot lately, and it's so frustrating, because there's no need for it.
Yeah, Paradox has been doing it for a while. Like, they've been doing it, you know, I know there are other people in this podcast play, you know, they're Crusader Kings and Europa Universalis and stuff like that. I play City Skylines. I never had an issue with it, but yeah, it is, like, just an extra step that's unnecessary.
And it runs, like, 5 processes in the background while it's going. So who knows what the heck they're running in there?
Well, and one of the other things, too, is, like, I've had times where... my first experience with the launcher for Civ 6 was that it didn't actually, like, launch in a window. It launched minimized for some reason, and the game wasn't running, and I just had no clue. So I kept clicking on the Civ 6 executable again on my desktop, like, wondering why the hell it's not running, why the hell Steam isn't coming up prompting me for a password, because I didn't know that there was this new intermediate step.
Yeah. We had one instance on our Turncast game where they installed a fix to try and fix the problem, and then ran the launcher. The launcher closed, or did not close, but it sat there, frozen, for a minute and a half before the game started.
Yeah, to be clear, for other people who are frustrated by the launcher, this is almost certainly the doing of 2K, not necessarily of Firaxis, so please do not direct your anger at Firaxis or specific developers. If anything, be mad at the parent company.
Well, the parent company's developers of this bullcrap launcher. So yeah, if you have specific 2K devs,
it is frustrating.
2K as a company.
Yeah, it is frustrating that we have to, you know, make disclaimers like that because there are always jerks on the internet who, like, issue death threats and stuff like that to, like, totally the not right places. Not that there's any right place to ever issue a death threat. But, like, yeah, don't be going on, like, you know, and harassing the developers over this sort of thing, because it is almost certainly not their fault and most definitely not their decision.
Yeah, there are very specific reasons when issuing a death threat is considered okay, one of which is, you know, you murdering somebody else, but, you know, still not a good idea.
Yeah, and even then we have, like, courts and laws for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We at Polycast do not condone...
In the moment, like, somebody has just holding your family member hostage in front of you or something, I will forgive you then.
Yeah.
Although I might not recommend that as a strategy, but I won't hold you ethically in any problems for threatening then.
Yeah, we at Polycast do not generally condone vigilante justice.
The opinions of person X does not necessarily reflect whatever.
No, but the gestures I was making Saturday were reflecting my opinion of that launcher.
Yeah, if you want mods, you could just do it like RimWorld.
Cool. speaking of lopsided chariots, I guess, kind of, Bojavis over on Cybernetic Center was asking, do you ever accept the AI proposed trades? And they said, honestly, at this point, they just close out the windows as best they can. They never offer anything interesting or useful. Every great once in a while, it's decent enough, and you know you're going to get some friendliness points with them, so you go ahead and take it. But yeah, most of the time, no.
I'll sell off. Go ahead. Go ahead.
The infamous, give me 13 horses, and I'll give you this, and this, or your diplomatic points, and this, and for 2 gold per turn. What?
I'll sell my diplo favor if I think I need money, but other than that, not really.
Well, especially if you're, if you captured a capital or two and you're getting negative diplomatic favor per turn, then at that point you might as well just sell it for gold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be gone before you can use it anyway.
Sometimes if they want to take my great works and I don't want to win a culture victory, I'll let them have those. But it's a very rare time when I accept the AI trade.
I find that I'm more willing to accept them, like, later in the game as the game goes on, because it's, you know, I usually have so much gold and resources and stuff anyway, and, like, it's unlikely to, you know, change the outcome of the game at that point. So if one of my, like, friendlier allied civs pops up and they want something, you know, in, like, the modern or information era, I'll usually just click yes just to get them to go away and leave me alone.
Yeah, cause, and also, in a sense, you're buying goodwill points, basically, so that they don't decide to turn around and backstab you while you're busy elsewhere.
Don't backstab me. My troops are on the other side of the world.
Well, no, that's the perfect time to backstab, obviously.
But it's the AI. I don't want it to backstab me, because that's just a hassle.
Yeah. Wait till I declare war on somebody, and then, oh, now you want to... Couldn't have done that like 5 turns ago before I moved everything across an ocean. Thanks, game.
Yeah, I really missed that give me 10 turns to prepare option that was in Civ 5.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was helpful. You know, so yeah, okay, we'll declare the joint war. You just got to give me a little bit to be ready.
Yeah, let me not let my units get ambushed by this declaration of war that's happening not on my turn. Thank you.
Does anybody know if the AI would still ask you to go to war with them if they decided they didn't want to go to war during that 10-turn time?
I do not specifically recall.
I don't either.
It's been a while. I want to say once they asked you that they didn't, but I'm not 100% sure. It's like, because they've gone through the their checklist of why do I want to declare on this person and all of that, so they wouldn't ask you until they're absolutely sure, and it would be very odd for them to change their mind in just 10 turns.
Yeah, I don't know if that evaluation is happening every turn or how often it happens anyway, so it might even be that they don't even, like, check again until that comes up. But if they do, it would at least be nice if the AI civ would, like, come to you and be like, yeah, we changed our minds, don't worry about that anymore. Preferably as soon as they decide they're not going to do it anymore, so that I can, you know, stop moving my units across the board.
People have lucked out sometimes. Somebody offered Poland one of their a couple of their excess luxuries, and Daddy was like, take all my relics. Which, wow, I wouldn't get that one. That's actually a good trade.
Yeah, I've seen recently the AI has been, like, selling off its great works just left and right. Like, anytime I have an available slot, somebody comes to me and is like, hey, you want our great work of writing? They also, a lot of times, just want to trade a great work for another great work, which I've always found, like, confusing. I don't know why they do that, especially in the case of writing, where none of the structures that you can put writing in have theming bonuses, so there's, like, no point in changing a great work of writing. So, I don't know why they do that.
I kind of miss the Civ 5 theming system because it was more dynamic.
Yeah, there's a wider variety of ways that you could theme buildings, and Civ 5 also had the benefit of, like, the same civilization isn't the one getting all of the great people of a particular type because Civ 5 didn't have the district system.
Well, you should be getting all the great people of the same type, even with the district system.
Right, but if for the great artist people, I found that like, there tends to be one civ that, especially in the AIs, that, like, gets almost all of them, and then none of the other civs have great works at all. Maybe it's because they sold them all off, I don't know.
Or maybe because somebody wanted to buy them all. Possible.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. And in that case, like, I mean, the great works still provide a decent chunk of culture, which helps you through the civic tree and expands the borders of your cities, so it's not like they don't do anything if you're not going for a culture victory. So I do feel like the AIs are a little bit too willing to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Because I'll take them. Like, there's no reason not to just have one sitting, you know, in your amphitheater. Like I said, it's just extra culture that you're getting per turn, which, you know, speeds up your ability to get new governments and unlock valuable policies and civics.
And elsewhere in the field, they're talking about they usually reject open borders offers. But what I've seen people, like, different people playing on Deity, actually, they'll go, especially early on, they'll actually go ahead and accept that because it can delay the Deity AI from attacking you. Like, it'll give you that extra 10 or 20 turns to get out some more units so you have a better defense when they do inevitably come after you.
One of the other advantages to having the open borders is that if you notice the AI starts to walk all of its units through your territory, you kind of then know that they're not coming for you, they're just trying to get to somebody on the other side of you. Because if they're coming for you, they just camp outside your borders, because I think even the AI knows that if they move into your borders and then declare war, all their units just get kicked out anyway.
And usually with the AI, it's like, oh, there's a city-state over there that's useful to me, but the AI wants it. It's like,
Yeah, I found a lot of times that's what it is there is, like, a city-state, and they just want to kill city-states, even though they can't possibly hold that city-state because it'll just loyalty flip in, like, five turns anyway. And in that case, I guess, you know, probably a free city for you, depending on how the loyalty pressure is working.
Generally.
Yeah.
So there's reasons to do it. It just comes down to what you think the AI is going to do with that open borders.
Yeah, later on in the game, you're less likely to do it, but early on, it's like, well, they're just going to walk through, you know? And sometimes you want the open borders from your side, so you can walk through them, and it's like, where are all your cities, so I know exactly where to aim things.
Yeah, or to bring back my scouts or galleys that are trapped on the other side of their borders.
Because you pick that one hex.
And then, of course, they ask me to move all my troops from their borders, even though it is one friggin' scout. And we have open borders, so, like, you shouldn't be upset that he's in your borders to begin with.
Your borders threaten our troops. Or your troops threaten our borders, yeah.
Yeah, I want to send the AI a message
like your
saying...
your borders threaten our troops.
Yeah, exactly. I want to send a message to the AI saying, keep your borders away from my troops.
Keep your borders away
from
my troops. You're just so scared of my scout, and I don't understand.
It was a defensive-offensive war, I declared. Their borders are a threat.
Well, it's funny, though, Candace, because in actual practice, it does work out that way sometimes, just because of the
yeah.
way that border growth happens in Civ games.
Or they can settle near you and then complain immediately.
Yeah, why are your cities that have always been there so close to my city that was just put there two turns ago? Yeah, the joys of dealing with Civ AI.
You settled on land that I considered my own. My capital.
Yeah. Well, I can kind of relate to the AI with that.
Well, you consider all the land your own.
Not all of it.
Just most of it.
Just enough to win conquest. We don't need to grab every tundra city.
All right. Well, a few days ago, we had an article posted by PC Gamer titled How Civilization Could Reinvigorate the Ancient Series. I don't know that I'd really call Civilization an ancient game series, but okay. I mean, I guess it comes from the 90s, so...
In computer ages, that is ancient.
It's probably been around longer than the guy who wrote this article has been alive.
Yeah, probably.
I was going to point that out, too.
Firaxis still hasn't even released the final patch for Civ 6, and we've already got these think pieces starting to pop up talking about what Civ 7 could be or what they want it to be. And this particular article basically is complaining about, not necessarily complaining. I think there's some legitimate points here. So is airing some grievances with regard to, for example, how victory conditions work and how rigid the specific types of victories are. They also talk about wanting more diversity between civilizations, specifically to not have every civilization shoehorned into the same process of imperialism and industrialization that Western European societies all went through?
Well, all societies, though.
That survived, anyway.
Yeah. It's not like Westernization and imperialism are not Western-specific.
Yeah.
The Western world did industrialize first in some ways, but China had some industrialization before Europe did. And let's not even talk about how many different empires there were in the Middle East before Rome existed.
Right. One example they bring up is talking about the indigenous nations of the Pacific Northwest, and this article says that they, quote, produce more high-quality protein per square meter by cultivating salmon with far less labor, pollution, and ecological disruption than the best farming techniques of the European settlers that displaced them, unquote. I would like to see a source for that. It would be nice if they could at least link to a Wikipedia article or something, explaining how that works, instead of expecting us to do the research on our own.
Also, they got displaced, quote-unquote. That's a nice way of describing what happened. But in the context of Civ, that's you getting conquered because you didn't keep up in tech. So the way the game is modeling the competitive environment, sorry to say, but that's just what happens if you don't.
Well, I think
and it's not even the first time a highly advanced civilization got conquered or was ahead in a particularly... particularly ahead in some aspects of technology / development. We saw this with Egypt, we saw this with Rome, we saw this numerous times where nations that were ahead in at least some metrics still got conquered and displaced or completely wiped out as a result.
Or collapsed in on themselves.
Yeah.
Or all three.
Yeah, these things tend to coincide to some extent.
I think the complaint here at a more fundamental level is just that Civ does not allow you to build that kind of culture ever at any point during the game, which I think is a valid complaint. I in the past have expressed an interest in seeing nomadic civilizations implemented in different ways that don't require them to be building static cities the way that every other Civ in the game does. And there have been other games that have tried to do that. Total War Attila comes to mind, and were moderately successful.
The Total War Attila's mechanics for it, though, are kind of BS, not going to lie.
Yeah, I mean, the game is still quite good.
You can completely wipe out all of Attila's stuff, and it'll just respond the next turn. No thank you on that one. They're not even playing kind of the same game, and that's the problem. You have the asymmetric stuff that Soren was talking about, but at some point it turns into a slog too. You can't make it too asymmetrical in the design space. It has to still make sense, and wiping out all of Attila's armies only to have them instantly reappear does not make sense. That being said, the idea of having different Civs play differently is something that the series has been going for a long time, starting with Civ 3 and then progressing from there. We've seen increasingly marked differences between civilizations with each iteration of the game. The problem with making an entirely different playstyle is now you're going to have to cut down severely on the number of Civs you can put in the game. And that's not a trade-off that's made lightly or that everyone would like, because there's no way you could make all these new mechanics for each and every new Civ that exists in Civ 6.
Yeah.
And then expect them to interact sanely.
We have 50 Civs in the game. They can't all have individual mechanics, otherwise it would break.
True, but they could have a handful of archetypes and then have their own unique abilities and stuff to give flavor within those archetypes. It's doable. It would certainly be a very difficult task, especially when it comes to balancing, as Phil's complaints on Attila Total War bear out.
I would only be okay with that if you could choose which archetype you wanted at the start. And even then, yeah. I would complain, because I wouldn't like that I had to do what I wanted at the beginning and then got shoehorned into the rest of it.
Well, to some extent, you could represent this with government choices that exist in Civ 6 and just change how the mechanics of those governance influence the game. So it's not impossible to do.
Humankind, in its opening stages, has that nomadic, you wander around, you're just accumulating stuff, but there's still sort of a cap to it, and you're still forced to settle eventually. Like, that's the natural progression. You can't just, you could keep wandering, but I don't think you could wander infinitely.
You'd eventually lose, I would guess.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with the Mongols. A lot of them, a lot of them did conquer land and then just be assimilated into that land slash culture as the conquerors.
Oh yeah, it's definitely not the case. It's definitely not the case that these nomadic cultures like did not have cities or permanent settlements at all. They definitely did.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking about the ones that took over Iran or China. Like, it's like the Yuan Dynasty. It was a lot more China than Mongol towards the end of that.
Right, hence the new Kublai Khan leader for China.
Yeah. And so then, to what extent do you model that in the game if you're going to make a nomadic-style civilization?
Well, just make it so that the cities are places they return to every day. And then you can have the conceit that they're wandering around their land, but the land is still theirs because it has borders, but the cities are religious sites or government centers that aren't inhabited the whole year.
Well, there's also, I mean, there's also precedent for similar mechanics, like even within the Civilization series. Like, once again, Beyond Earth's expansion had the concept of the mobile aquatic cities, which moved very, very, very slowly, but, you know, were in some sense nomadic. So, you know, there could be iterations on that sort of idea where, you know, you have some civilizations that have fixed cities, some civilizations that maybe have cities that can move. You know, it's a possibility. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't.
The way to do that, you would have to separate borders from the city itself, because otherwise your borders would move every time your city moved, which meant all that somebody had to do was wait till your city was somewhere else and then snag the land you were wandering on, and then you couldn't go back.
Yeah. But one of the other things that you would probably have to do at a very, very fundamental level is you would have to change the way that, like, resources work. Because if you actually wanted nomadic wandering or moving cities around to be something that's viable, let alone necessary, you would probably need mechanics in place where you could actually consume all of the resources in a particular area and then have to move in order to find, you know, more fertile or more research rich land while you, you know, wait for the land you had previously occupied to, you know, become fertile again.
Well, then there's the problem of, okay, we are now a Bronze Age civilization. Where are we getting our bronze, copper? Because I don't think there's ever been a nomadic society that has ever been able to mine. And without bronze or without tin and copper, it's pretty much impossible to do a lot of civilization stuff.
Well, but that's again the fundamental complaint with the with the, you know, article that we're talking about is that it, you know, the game does not at all model these other ways of living and still has this very Eurocentric idea of how civilizations grow and develop, which, you know, is maybe not representative of how other cultures have done things.
But where are the cultures now?
Well, I mean, but the whole point of civilization is that it's all revisionist history, so it's not really a question of where are those cultures now.
No. The whole point of civilization is it's not history at all. This is all a conceit based on the idea of history. There's no actual history happening in Civ.
Well, right. I think we're in violent agreement at this point on that topic.
But that's what I'm... What my opinion is on this is just... We don't need to worry about trying to change the game fundamentally because the game is already not real. So it's like, why do we want to put realism into this if it doesn't work better? Because we don't want AIs to intentionally choose choices that will make them lose.
You know, one of their complaints is about being able to set their own goals. And, you know, because like they're saying that Civ is rigid in this expectation that you're supposed to keep going forward and go through the tech tree. And either try to, you're conquering it in some sort of different sense, whether it's a culture victory, a religious victory, a science victory, it's still a conquering in a sense. You know, you don't get, I mean, even though it's not technically, you know, I mean, a culture victory isn't really conquering. Everybody just loves your blue jeans, your rock music. But they would want to be able to choose their own goals. I'm sitting here trying to think, but you can go for the different victory types, and that is a different goal. They're comparing it with Crusader Kings, where you're just going off and doing strange things with your family thing. Like, you set a goal, I want to put this kind of person on the throne and conquer that, or conquer this one small area, even though it's really hard to hold together. You could do things. I'm sorry, I'm not articulating this very well.
Yeah, it's hard to have a game like Civ without concrete rules for victory.
Yeah,
I don't know how you would do it, actually.
Yeah, even Crusader Kings and, you know, by extension, Europa Universalis and all that, have an end date that you can't play past. I mean, there's mods to take that out, but you wouldn't want an infinite game of Civ because it would just get... It bogs down now when you get into the late game. You used to only be playing it after 1,000 turns. Yikes.
Well, there'd just be no meaningful decisions left at some point.
Unless you end up in an eternal war situation like that one guy in Civ 2.
Yeah, I guess. Although it was pretty obvious that that didn't need to be happening.
Well, no, but not everybody's as good a player as everybody else.
That's true. I'm just saying, even he would probably eventually either win or lose that. Probably. And then after which there would be no more decisions left on that game board, because it would just be all one Civ or the other Civ.
Definitely not a fun game to play, I'm sure. Playing a game for thousands of turns.
Well, a strategy game anyway. You just made me think of Dungeon Crawl. That's it.
Oh,
it would be
unusual.
You can win less than 50,000 turns, for example, but it would be you have to be really good to do that with any consistency. And most wins are in like the 80,000 to 110,000-ish range, I would say. But the turns don't work in Dungeon Call like they work in Civ, obviously. You can finish a game of Dungeon Call faster than you can typically finish a game in Civ.
Dungeon Call, if you took one more step, Civ is like, it's 10 years later.
Yeah. There's a lot more inputs per turn in Civ, and then input per turn bloat in Civ, for that matter.
There's a part of this article where it's talking about being upset that there's no refugee crises or endgame resource wars. And my only response to that is, do we really want to see that in our games? We kind of play games to get away from
it. I was just about to say that. We're playing this to escape from the real world.
Plus, refugee crises, like many things that are need to be abstracted some way anyway, don't really happen on Civ timescales. Like any historical refugee crisis just doesn't last 50 years. Either the refugees make it or they don't. So how do you want to put that in the game without being pretty nasty with its implementation and still giving it even a somewhat realistic nod, no thank you? That being said, it wouldn't hurt to have a migration mechanic, per se.
Or population displacement.
Yeah, I mean, that's not something that couldn't be done. I don't know that the game needs it, but...
The closest thing that Civ 6 currently has would be the loyalty system, where you conquer a civilization, and they have a large population city, so, you know, they're less loyal to you, and you have to work to re-earn it. The issue, though, is that they're not still loyal to the old civilization, so even if they culture flip, or loyalty flip, they flip to a free city and not, you know, back to the Civ that used to control them.
Yeah, and there's, you don't see significant population displacement from the conquered land into other land owned, still owned by that previous Civ or other Civs. And there's no contingency for the behavior of the conquerors dictating to what extent that happens.
Right, like Civ 4, for instance, had this, like, interesting but, like, completely underutilized mechanic where there were actually demographics within the cities. Like, I think it was in the bottom left corner of the city screen was this little meter that told you what population of your city was, like, your civilization's people versus a different, you know, culture population. But, like, there were no policies or anything that you could implement that would, like, affect... You know, how the populations from different cultures, like, were treated or how they interacted with each one another. So it was there, but it just never did anything.
That was for entirely for happiness and culture flipping mechanics. But it could have been used for more, but that's what it was used for.
Oh, did it contribute to culture flipping?
Yeah.
If you had a city that was predominantly somebody else's culture, it would have a chance at revolting, depending on the size of the garrison and a few other factors. And if it revolted twice and was not conquered previously by the Civ holding it, it could flip outright to other Civs.
Oh, I thought that was just based on border growth.
And you would also get unhappiness if the culture was primarily not yours.
Yeah, I know that also, I think if you declared war on the civilization and a very large chunk of your population originally belonged to that civilization, they would get upset with you and you'd have happiness penalties.
I'm trying to remember exactly how that worked.
I think there was a happiness modifier for, like, you're at war with our homeland or something like that that would show up on the...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was so minor compared to the other happiness penalties, though. Because you'd get one for fighting brothers and sisters of faith. You'd get them for war weariness, which was much more punitive than all the others combined when it came to war unhappiness. Yeah. Yeah, the unhappiness hit from fighting the same culture was chump change compared to accruing war weariness. Never did like how that mechanic worked exactly. You nuked our friend.
You dudes, full stop. What are you doing?
No, they didn't care. You only got a penalty with people if you nuked somebody they liked or you nuked them. If you nuked somebody that they were, like, cautious or lower with, or, like, you're their worst enemies or whatever, they did not care. You could launch 300 nukes, and, yeah, I would not bat an eye. There's no default penalty for that.
Well, I think the check in Civ 4 for launching too many nukes was, like, the radioactive fallout or pollution or whatever.
Yeah.
Well,
that was localized.
It's not going very far.
Yeah, I don't think Civ 4... Did you get global warming in Civ 4?
Yeah, but it was just turning random tiles into desert, and it hit everybody equally. So, like, even though you're kind of screwing yourself, you're screwing everybody else equally as well. So that wasn't really a strong disincentive in a conquest-based game to using nukes at all. And then Fallout was local. Like, it would only hit in target tile and the surrounding tiles. So... you can launch so many nukes as you wanted into that tile. Now, if you wanted to use the city afterwards, well, you probably shouldn't be nuking it. But if you want to win the war, nukes definitely get the job done.
Or lower population, because lowering other Civ's population in Civ 4 was actually a direct path to victory, because there was domination? I always get them confused. The one where you just needed, like, 60% of the world's population and area, and you would win.
That was domination, but you are usually gated on territory rather than pop for domination.
Right.
But where nuking population came into relevance, ironically, was for diplomatic victory conditions. Because the AI would not care if you nuked enemies or people didn't care about, you could nuke away the population of anybody who wouldn't vote for you. While leaving your friendly
right, because the
alone.
Number of votes that they had was based on population, right?
Correct. So you would nuke down their population, and as a result of that action, win diplomatically. The UN has decided that the nuclear power is
It's Teddy Roosevelt's big stick.
Yeah.
The big stick is a glowy big stick.
Big bada boom.
I loved winning that way. It was so stupid, but fun. Yeah, victory conditions are a problem. They're still a problem. Like, it's an unsolved problem.
Well, I was just reading up last night on how humankind is planning on doing it, and apparently it's essentially like a victory point system. You accrue fame over the course of the game by performing certain actions that seem like they're roughly analogous to era score kind of things in Civ 6. And if you have the most fame at the end of the game, you win.
Yeah, interesting. We'll see if it works. Both humankind and Old World are trying to shake that up, and I think that's healthy. Yeah, we'll find something that's good eventually.
Well, I think that's also something that was mentioned in the PC Gamer article that we were talking about. They did mention that Civ might not be able to just rest on its laurels, because there actually is viable competition in that very specific niche market now. That hasn't been there for, you know, at least, like, what, 10, 15, 20 years?
That's also healthy, and Civ needed that competition, for sure.
So, you know, part of the idea of that article, I think, was that Civ needs to, as they say, reinvigorate the game if they want to remain the industry leader in that particular niche.
Well, that's a reasonable thing to say. I think many of the suggestions in this particular article would see Civ drop from industry leader pretty heavily.
Yeah, because there's also the things they can change Civ some, but they can't change it as drastically, I think, as the writer wants, because then it's not Civ, and there's a certain fan base that expects Civ to at least have some certain baseline features, and that's going to alienate a lot of people. Because there's even people between Civ 5 and Civ 6 that are like, nah, I'll pass. So.
Yeah, although that rift wasn't as bad as 4 to 5.
Well, and a lot of the people that I know who still play Civ 5 and don't play Civ 6 do it because they feel like Civ 6 wasn't as big of a difference from Civ 5. They felt like it was too similar, and, you know, they were just weary of just playing the same game over and over again.
Man, I don't know. Five and six are pretty different.
Well, a lot of that came from when Civ 6 Vanilla came out, where, like, a lot of the mechanics in Civ 6 Vanilla were pulled directly from, Civ 5 Brave New World. Virtually same trade route system, very similar, great work system. You know, all that stuff was just very, very comparable. It was, a lot of people thought it was basically just Civ 5 with districts. And I keep trying to tell these people that, okay, well, maybe you should then give Rise and Fall and Gathering Storm a chance. And, you know, they just have that, that bitter taste, I guess, in their mouth that makes them not want to, even take the time to go back, which is, unfortunate, because just like with previous games, the expansions improved Civ 6 a lot. Like, I sure as heck would not want to go back to Civ 5 vanilla after having played either of Civ 5's expansions, and I wouldn't want to do the same with Civ 6 either.
It is an unfortunate thing with DLC for extended periods of time. Any new release from the series would have to integrate almost all of that stuff into the new version, or it's just the worst game for a long time. I wonder how long it will take until CK3 is actually a better game than CK2.
And
it might happen eventually, but it's nowhere near it right now.
Yeah, and I thought Civ 6 did a pretty good job in that regard, because, like I said, they ported a lot of the popular mechanics from Brave New World and from Gods and Kings. The religion system is still basically the same as what was introduced in Gods and Kings. They just ported all that stuff over, and Civ 6 has vanilla had a mechanic set that was, very, very comparable to what was available in Civ 5 with two expansions. You could disagree about whether or not it worked as well, and we have done so in the past. But, it was all there. It wasn't like going from, The Sims 2 to The Sims 3 where, now you don't have your pets anymore or apartments or jobs and all that stuff is just gone and you're starting over from basically just Civ 2 but with better graphics again. Sims 2 vanilla but with better graphics again.
Don't worry, guys. Civ 7 will have at least as much quality as the Madden custom franchises.
Oh my.
At least.
Oh no.
But
I would play The Sims once if they didn't cost $180.
They have a similar problem with Paradox where they have this many expansions and stuff packs and all this stuff. And
well, it's, they're all $40.
Yeah.
And they're the same exact expansions or exact same concepts that you bought from the previous game. It's, you have a pets expansion, you have an expansion where they get to live in apartments, you have an expansion where they get to go to college, you have an expansion where they run their own businesses from home, maybe you have an expansion where, like, they can go camping and stuff like that. Like, it's all the same things, and they're packaged the same. They just change the name that's on the box and resell it to you again at $40.
They're cash cow.
I would fully expect that when Civ 7 comes out, it will also port a lot of the popular mechanics from, Civ 6's expansions. I expect some variation of probably loyalty to appear in Civ 7 vanilla. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the disaster and climate change systems are ported over, not necessarily verbatim, but something similar. Surely districts will probably be a staple in the series going forward.
I don't like districts, but that's just...
Yeah, the PC Gamer article also had complaints about, districts and the way that they look, especially at Endgame, where it's just constant urban sprawl. I personally think that could be addressed by just having the map designed so that there's more space between cities, so that you still have the large urban centers, but then also have the large farming and pastoral areas, like out in the countryside, because right now there's just almost no distinction between urban center and countryside in by the end of the game. So that at least is something that I think we are all in agreement on with that particular PC Gamer article.
We need more tiles. Actually, the article was mostly, I don't like how they look compared to how we feel, where it's like, I wish there was more space.
Civ 7 could use districts and not have them be the same as Civ 6, too. That's another way they can go with it. They can change them mechanically a lot while still keeping the base concept of something that gets adjacency bonus and is vaguely centered on one type of output. But there's still a lot of changes there.
I don't like that I have to build the district individually and then I get stuff from it.
That doesn't have to be the case. You could just make a district zoning rule, for example.
Like, literally all I want is a library. Why do I have to build a campus and then a library?
It would be more like you should build the library first and then you putting subsequent science buildings there and then it becomes the district.
Yeah.
Maybe you just build an empty district, right, and it just has, like, housing or whatever to house more of your population, and then, you put buildings in it, and then it becomes specialized over time.
No, I don't want to build district, though.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily have to. Like, they could maybe have a... Go ahead.
When a city grows, it doesn't build something and then build on top of it. It builds when it needs something new, and then it grows as it builds.
Right. Well, what I was getting at would be more like the population just settles there, like, kind of similar to how tiles are annexed by the city. The population would just move to that place because there's resources there or whatever, and there would be, like, essentially the equivalent of, like, a neighborhood there. You didn't build it. Like, the city would build it automatically, and then you would have the choice of putting buildings in it to specialize it, was kind of where I was going.
Time for SimCity 2000 zoning.
And that would be an option.
As long as I could relocate where they went automatically, it would be okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could,
sounds like a pretty cool idea.
And you could have a similar system where you can just pay gold or whatever, or, spend production to put the thing where you want it instead of just letting it happen automatically, but then there's, the opportunity cost of then you're not spending that on something else, just like with tile annexation.
Or designate where you want it to go before it happens.
Yeah, and that would also be something that would be very nice to have four tiles for Axis.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's different ways that sort of stuff can be. And I just think, in general, there does need to be more space between cities just because of the way that the one unit per tile works. Like, you shouldn't
The beginning of five, yeah.
Yeah, you should not have an army that, like, a single army that occupies the entire land area of the country you're invading. Like, that's a little bit ridiculous.
I don't think that even happened in World War II.
Carpet siege.
Right, yeah, no. And that can either be done with, more spaces between cities, or you could actually make this, just to have more tiles, and the cities take up more tiles. Like a city center could potentially just be more than one tile if the tiles are small and granular enough. But then you run into, technical issues and engine limitations. So,
well,
I don't know how feasible that is.
Hopefully Civ 7 will be on an...
Oh, yeah. Hopefully. But there's a lot of different ways they could go with that sort of thing. But either way, I am pretty confident that districts will be a staple in the game for at least the next few iterations, unless they come up with some, radical different idea that replaces it.
We'll have to wait and see. I still think Civ 7 will come out this October or something.
Like, release this October?
Yeah.
Dang.
Man, I'd be surprised.
I would be surprised, because we haven't heard anything yet. We usually get at least a half a year-ish ahead of time.
Yeah,
so.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's an announcement this fall, but I would be very surprised if an actual game came out.
Yeah, that is true, isn't it? Never mind. I retract my prediction. Because I was thinking it was the way that it used to be, but the way that it used to be is long dead, so... Because usually we get an expansion pack in July, and then the next year is when the announcement comes. But we're getting expansion packs now. So, we're not expansion packs, DLCs.
Well, and again, I would like to point out that previously there was the track record of there being that other game in between, like, major Civ releases. You know, we had Beyond Earth and, like, Civ 4 Colonization was between Civ 4 and Civ 5.
That could be as well. Who knows?
So, yeah,
maybe they'll remake Pirates again. I would actually love that.
Or, didn't Sid Meier also have a Railroads game?
Yes. I would like to see that remade again, although there are some pretty good remakes of Railroad Tycoon out now.
Or a full PC/console version of, was it Sid Meier's Airplanes? What was the mobile game that they made a few years ago that was... was it called Sid Meier's Airplanes?
Sid Meier's, shoot.
Ace Combat?
It's not Ace Combat. Ace Combat is from Japan.
Okay.
No, there was a Firaxis developed game. I think it was only on mobile platforms, and it was a Sid Meier
theme as well.
Yeah, it was a Sid Meier branded thing about like airplane
Ace Patrol.
There, that was it.
I have played that game. It is a very Sid Meier game.
I don't think it performed
very good game.
I don't think it performed very well though.
Oh, probably not because it was a mobile game. It was a mobile game that was as well designed as a non-mobile game, which meant that it wasn't designed well as a mobile game.
Well, and it probably also costs money, which most people on the mobile platform are averse to spending, even though they'll spend crap tons of money once they've played the game.
Well, yeah, this was also several years ago, before paid apps was a real thing.
Yeah, it was back when there was the expectation that mobile games were free, and that you would just have to pay to make them not suck once you started playing them.
Yeah.
So having a game that you had to pay for up front, but which was actually, like, decent or good up front, was, like, blew people's minds, and they just couldn't comprehend how that could possibly work.
Right.
Hey, have you guys tried Raid Shadow Legends?
No.
No. No, no, no.
All right, well, does anyone else have anything else to say about that PC gamer?
Nope.
Nope.
Well, you guys were all quiet for so long. I'm like, okay, I guess we're done. Anyway. Thank you for listening to Polycast episode. What is it, 382?
I think so, yes.
Yes, I'm Michael Lou, who's a little too fast with the cue today, and I'm joined by Kenneth Alvarez.
I survived. Good.
The me and team.
Reinvigorating the military units.
And Mega Bears fan.
Back to making lots and lots and lots of money with Portugal.
You've got to get those microtransactions in.
Microtransaction Portugal? What would that be?
Macro transition Portugal.
What?
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 I don't know.
No, Phil.
You got to be careful there, Candace. You can joke about adding microtransactions, but somebody at a publisher will take the idea seriously and run with it.
That's right, don't do it.
No matter how silly the idea seems to you, someone at a publisher will take it and run with it.
If they do, they will lose a customer. Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interact. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.
Woohoo! I'm just seeing that we also have some comments on the YouTube, a few from Gamer Trojan. First is, yeah, I agree the game does not offer enough alternatives, money, or faith rules, Civ, period. Also, Civ is now more SimCity than about a civilization. Second post is, at least Stellaris offers many alternative civic or government types, and money is trade if you want it, or energy if not. And then the third and final post is, really looking forward to Humankind. That looks more Civ than Civ currently does.
Who is this guy?
The name that they have on here is Gamer Trojan. Possibly a first-time listener.
Yeah.
Which means I wish I had seen this so that we could talk about it while the show was still on, but...
Yeah.
We've just gotten so used to nobody being to chat anymore, I think. Or at least saying anything during...
Yeah, it had been so long since we've had... discussion there, but that would be nice. It's just we don't have it.
I am still recording, so I could tack this on to the end.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think we should.
So, yeah, so anyone want to have any thoughts on those particular comments?
I think he's wrong, but that's okay.
Well, again, well, I mean, that in the meta sense, it's a reflection of our real world where money rules a lot of things.
Well, I mean, saying Stellaris is a better 4X game than Civ, kind of a stretch.
Did he say that?
That's what he was implying.
I mean, there are systems that he likes more in Stellaris than what Civ does, and that's fair.
And also, to be fair to Civ, Stellaris did, post-release, collapse a lot of those options into one option because they couldn't get them balanced properly in the FTL rules.
Yeah, there's no balancing that. I didn't even play the game at the time. I haven't actually played the game at all. I've seen some videos on it, though. There's no way they were going to balance that.
Yeah, I liked the flavor and variety that it offered, and I was very disappointed and frustrated when it was taken out. But I also
major salt.
Yeah, I was not playing the game competitively or like at any like hardcore degree like other players were, so I didn't really pick up on like how poorly balanced it was.
I picked up on it a little bit that if depending on which tech you got, either you had an advantage or you were at a disadvantage because you could have them just like pop into your system and you have almost no warning.
Yeah. There's just no counterplay for that degree of mobility.
Yeah, and yeah, some of them had like ridiculously long range. Like you could go pretty much anywhere. Like the warp drive in the original version of Stellaris, like you could basically move anywhere in the galaxy within a certain range. There were like no restrictions at all.
Yep. And it was objectively the best thing as a result.
Yeah, I certainly liked it the best. The other ones basically I felt like they just added restrictions, which just made it harder to use them and without them necessarily being particularly more powerful.
I'm always interested to see comments like X is more like Civ than Civ or whatever. Because like, people have different things in their head as to what Civ is supposed to be, I think.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true, even within this panel.
Yeah. Well, that's my preferences, for sure. And then there's the history of how what has actually been done in Civilization games, which is not preference, that's just what happened in the past. But some people even disagree on that, or forget some of the earlier choices of the series.
Well, we are
just... Nope.
Yeah, that's true.
We are living in the post-truth era where people can disagree on what happened in the past.
Well, I wouldn't call that post-truth, I would call that historical.
Yeah.
I mean, we do have some people in this day and age trying to argue that against using empirical evidence and having multiple truths for multiple people, and that's not a respectable position whatsoever. Now, if there's, like, a historical event that happened and we aren't sure of the circumstances around it, there can be reasonable disagreement on what led to that event or how important one thing was for that event happening versus another or whatever.
Well, right.
So that's not something we can measure objectively down to minutia.
Yeah, but when it comes to what mechanics were and were not in a previous iteration of a video game, that's there's not much room for debate.
Yeah, not really.
Unless the mechanic was hidden, didn't act.
Well, there's certainly lots of opportunity for people not knowing or not remembering that mechanics were in games, especially considering how games have become more living products that change dramatically over time, like, for example, Stellaris used to have multiple FTL methods, and now it only has the one.
Like,
so,
there used to be a DLC for EU4 that got turned into the Women of Something DLC. Nobody remembers what that DLC was.
So, like, people paid for a DLC, and then, like, it stopped existing and was turned into a different paid DLC?
I think they were planning on a DLC, then baked it into the Women in History, DLC.
It was the Women in History DLC was a DLC that was renamed that after a previous DLC was already released. It was weird because I never downloaded the Women in History DLC. I just suddenly had it. And I know
that one was made free intentionally.
But
there isn't a lot in it other than flavor. Like there's no mechanical alterations.
But there was an existing DLC that it replaced.
Not to my knowledge.
As far as I know, that's what happened, but it's been a long...
I don't think it replaced any paid DLC. It might have replace something that was put on the chopping block before release, but I don't think it replaced anything that was put in
like
the game.
One of the random unit pack things that released with the deluxe edition.
Oh, that could be, yeah.
I never downloaded the Women in History DLC. I just had it.
Yeah, but it was free, so it doesn't surprise me that it would just be enabled for everybody by default.
But I don't have the Yuletide DLC, and that's also
free. Huh. Yeah, I don't know then.
The DLC you have to actively go and get the DLC for it to be, thankfully.
Unless they just push it into a patch. Because technically, patches are downloadable content.
Oh.
if we want to be technical about this, you do download them, and they change the game, sometimes significantly, sometimes even altering the mechanics outright. And there's no choice.
Do we need to alter the naming convention so that it's a P-DLC?
I kind of like that, the sound of P-DLC, lol.
Police Department, loadable content.
Yeah, we're going to be put on some list as a result of our actions in these games and get a visit from the Police Department. I watched one too many nuke. Or maybe I just played Rimworld too long. That would probably get their attention more.
I was going to say...
Yeah, you're playing that Hitler mod a little more often than we'd like for you to be.
We heard you when you said fascism is the most objective form of government.
It is what I said is that it is objectively the best form of government, and then with a small delay in Hearts of Iron. And it's true in Hearts of Iron. It is so ridiculous, the degree to which it is a better option than your alternatives.
Well, I would assume that in any game that is exclusively about fighting a war, a government type that is just state-enforced military-industrial complex is going to have many advantages.
Well, it should have some, but it should also have plenty of disadvantages, because historically it had many disadvantages. And you could balance the game around having those trade-offs, but instead, no, fascism is strictly better than communism, democracy, and non-aligned in Hearts of Iron. Strictly better. Like, the things you get for communists are minuscule, and democracy is nothing but penalties in practice. Come on now.
I downloaded a game a few months ago and tried playing a little bit of it, but I just could not figure out what the hell I was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, look, any other Paradox title, there's a lot of learning curve.
I thought that, like, I could translate some of my Crusader Kings 3 experience, and, like, just all the systems for doing everything are just so... Like, I couldn't figure out how to build units, I couldn't figure out how to deploy them, I couldn't figure out how to declare a war. I was just like, my gosh. I thought there'd
some
be some...
Some can't justify war. Democracies cannot justify wars. Unless the target has already generated world tension and is not a democracy. And that is an enormous restriction. And it's also completely inconsistent with the history leading up to the game. Like, how the fuck did UK get all of these colonial holdings if they couldn't declare wars? Come on now. What the fuck? Same for France or Netherlands. All these are democracies that totally can't declare war, guys. We forgot how to do it. Never mind this enormous amount of territory in Africa with our colors. We don't know how to start wars. Yeah. Yeah, okay. And, like, non-aligned, which represents mostly the pre-ideology stuff, like monarchies or that kind of setup, also cannot justify wars for some reason until a substantial amount of war tension has been generated, which is asinine. You want to tell me that Middle Eastern countries couldn't fight each other the last 50 to 100 years, say otherwise?
Well, it's not declaring war. It's what did Woodrow Wilson call it? It's the spreading American values or whatever.
Nah.
Spreading democracy at gunpoint.
The fascists and communists can justify wars right away, which means your first move is nearly every minor in the game is to switch to fascism. Now, why is it so much better? Because its subjects are better. Its puppet states are better. I mean, well, same thing really, and. Once you are in a war with a major, you can justify additional wars in a tiny fraction of the time. So rather than waiting like a third of a year to declare another war, you wait somewhere between 10 to 30 days. It's such a massive difference in the rate at which you can expand. And one of the downsides, democracies don't like you. But democracies don't like you if you declare war anyway. And amusingly, if you are playing as a fascist nation and go to war with the Axis, you can still get invitations into the Allies, so you can still even fight with the Allies if you want. So stupid. Whole thing is stupid. And that's by not even close to the biggest issue with the game. The biggest issues of the game come down to controlling your units and who gets land during and after war. Those are broken mechanics. Peace conferences are broken, but so is war score. And who gets territory when an army marches in. All those things are completely broken. And it's a shame, because Hearts of Iron could be a really fun game if it worked, but it doesn't work. And so, like, I only come back to it now and then, because it's so frustrating to play it. Because it doesn't work. Objectively. The core mechanics do not function. Rant over for now, I suppose.
I would have been happy if I could have just gotten past the tutorial and known what the heck I was doing.
Oh, that's always a problem in Paradox games, too.
Yeah,
I would argue that that is also a failing of the UI. You should be able to figure out how to play the game from the information available in the game.
Yeah, Crusader Kings 3 is the first, like, Paradox-developed game that I was actually able to, like, where the tutorial, I feel, actually taught me enough of the game that I could go and start actually playing the game.
Give it a few years and see if that's still true.
Yeah, right.